DiscerningHearts.com presents Beginning to Pray with Dr. Anthony Lillis. Dr. Lillis is an associate professor and the academic dean of St. John's Seminary in Camarillo, California, as well as the academic advisor for the St. Juan Diego House of Priestly Formation for the Archdiocese of Los Angeles. Through the years, clergy, seminarians, religious, and lay faithful have benefited from his lectures and retreat conferences on the Carmelite Doctors of the Church and the writings of St. Elizabeth of the Trinity. He is the author of Hidden Mountain Secret Garden, a theological contemplation of prayer, as well as numerous other books focused on the spiritual life. In this series of conversations with Dr. Lillis, we focus on Doctor of the Church, St. Teresa of Avila, and her great spiritual masterwork, The Interior Castle. Beginning to Pray with Dr. Anthony Lillis. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Welcome, Anthony.
Hello, Chris. It's good to be with you.
I am looking forward to the conversations we're going to have. I'm sure it will take us a few episodes to discuss one of probably, they're all important mansions, but the fourth mansion, that we seem to cross over a threshold, don't we?
That's right. This is probably the most critical thing of her work. These ideas that she has in this chapter are the ones that I think she is best developed. For those of you who've read the life of Teresa of Avila, she began to approach the problem of this transition from prayer in which we're primarily in control to prayer where God takes control. And she introduces that in her life, and then in The Way of Perfection, she develops it a little bit more. And here, it's kind of like the flowering of a lifetime of prayer and spirituality, where she's able to probably provide some of the clearest light in terms of this transition from one kind of prayer to another any literature ever written.
Wow. It is an area that you hear people that when they read The Interior Castle, that it can be confusing. Many people feel, with a lack of a better way of saying it, they've achieved this point. And yet in reality, we may not have. Is that fair to say?
Well, I think people look at the mansion sometimes as like, you know, a range of mountains that they're trying to climb. And so I made it to this peak, and so there's the next peak, you know. And sometimes they're on one peak and they're looking at another, and in their imagination, they climb the other one and they're really on the earlier one, or they think they're much higher than they are and that kind of thing. Well, this is not the image she gives us. She gives us the image of a beautiful palace, a mansion, or a complex with lots of dwelling places. And some of the dwelling places are closer to the center, and some are more on the outskirts, but it's a huge, beautiful space for living. And one thing about anybody's house that we know is that there are rooms that you live in and you spend a lot of time in, and other rooms that you kind of pass through. And so someone can be dwelling for the most of their life really in the periphery of their soul because they, for whatever reason, haven't made progress or haven't done the hard work of human maturity. That's possible. And then God calls them and they go deeper in the mansion. They might even come into this fourth mansion, this fourth dwelling place where God begins to act in a very special way. And it's maybe not where they dwell for the rest of their life. Maybe they're just there for a little bit, but they get a little bit of a taste. Other people, for whatever reason, in a very short time, they're on the outskirts. God calls them, and they go right through this mansion into the even more intimate dwelling places with God. Some of the rest of us wonder, astounded, how they could make so much progress so quickly when there are others who've devoted their whole life to trying to get out of the first one or two dwelling places and can't seem to be making any progress. But Teresa of Avila says that normally people spend a lot of time in the first three mansions before God invites them into this fourth place of intimacy with the Lord. But she uses the word and she stresses that this is the normal course of events. can be that somebody gets called a little bit earlier. And then there's also the phenomena that I've mentioned and that she describes elsewhere, where somebody can be kind of invited to deeper intimacy, and then God sends them back to where they're more comfortable dwelling, but he's put something in their soul that makes them long for more intimacy. And that was the whole purpose of granting them the favor of more intimacy than they were really ready for, is it makes them long for it so that they're not so satisfied where they are. I say all of this, the thing that I think you were talking about is this phenomena where somebody will kind of assume that they've reached the highest levels of mysticism, and it's all kind of a head trip in their head and in their imagination. They've imagined it to be so, and they think it is so because they think they understand this part or that part of spiritual progress. But what we understand and what we imagine isn't quite the same thing as what is. And so a great deal of humility is called for. Whenever I read this, to tell you the truth, when I read about the first mansion, I see myself in the first mansion. When I read about the second mansion, I see myself in the second mansion. In the fourth mansion, my experience shifts because in the first three mansions, I so readily see myself there. In this fourth mansion, it's kind of like, well, I must have seen this or been part of this because I'm understanding too much of what she says. And if I've never experienced anything like this at all, she herself tells me that none of this would make sense to me. So I must have had some kind of experience of this. I wonder what it was. And I can never quite put my finger on it. And the same goes for the higher mansions. And all I can think of in my own case is that I think there are places that the Lord has allowed me to visit to make me desire more, and other places where I kind of dwell and fight it out more on a day-to-day basis. And those are the earlier mansions. I hope that I grow up spiritually and learn to dwell in this fourth mansion and the higher mansions after this, because what God does here is so beautiful and so needed in the church today. How's that for a short answer?
I love it. I love it. Because ultimately, I mean, isn't the test that Teresa has guided us through, I mean, the story of her life, but she also talks about it in the Way of Perfection. And in the beginnings of the castle, is that you kind of have the standard of humility. Humility is a real hallmark, isn't it?
Yep. One of the sure ways that you know that you're actually making progress in your spiritual life, in your life of prayer, is you can't see it yourself. The moment you see it yourself and start praising it yourself, you ruin it. You know, oh, look how humble I am. I mean, that kills it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But your spiritual director might point to the fruit and you hear it with disbelief. You know, boy, I really see that the Lord has done a new work of humility in you. And you hear that and your knee-jerk reaction is, I'm not so sure he really knows how prideful I really am, you know. And mm-hmm. And if that's kind of the fallback disposition, that's normally healthy. But if our fallback disposition is, yes, I certainly have grown in humility and other wonderful virtues in my life. Too bad other people aren't as humble as I am, you know. If that's the fallback, then that we're in a lot of trouble because we're self-deceived and delusional. Mm. So, but humility is kind of the gold standard. And normally we can't see it ourselves, and it ruins everything when we try to see it ourselves. Normally somebody else has to help us see that this fruit is being born in us, even if we don't quite believe them.
Now, you mentioned something very important in passing here, the importance of sharing your experiences, as you said, with a spiritual director, or if you don't have a spiritual director, at least good spiritual friends, and maybe a confessor. But it is important to share, isn't it?
Yes, it's important to share for a variety of reasons. One of them is that it protects you against what I also just mentioned is self-delusion. Self-delusion is a huge problem in the spiritual life when you try to make progress, because we want the Lord so bad in our life and our desires can be so intense, but precisely because of their intensity, if that intense desire is not submitted to the rule of faith, if it's not if it's not surrendered to the completely to the providence of God, that desire can also occasion what you might call ego inflation, or the presumption that just because I desire something, I already attain it. It's true that in some sense, when you desire something, you do already have a connection with it, but you don't have that full possession that only God can give. And a good spiritual director, a good spiritual friend, a good confessor will help you kind of go, you know, Lilith, you sound like you're a little bit full of yourself right now. Mm. And you just need somebody, a voice of reality to say that to you. Or, you know, you're a little bit way too discouraged about what you call a lack of progress. Actually, God is doing a lot in your life right now. All these problems that you're seeing aren't the result of your prayer. Prayer is helping you finally see these things. And that's the first step to getting healed, is seeing them. And so in the spiritual life, oftentimes there's the appearance that we're going backwards or we're going forwards. And sometimes in that appearance of going forwards, we're actually going backwards. And other times in the what we experience is going backwards is actually going forward. And only somebody else, our own vision of ourselves is distorted. But somebody else gifted by the Holy Spirit can see the truth of what's going on. The role of a good spiritual director is to help you see the beautiful thing that God is doing in your heart and to help you discern the best counsel to cooperate with this beautiful thing that God is doing. Because God always does the most beautiful, exquisite, and wonderful things. But we can't respond to Him on our own. God's created us to need to rely on each other. And the relationship between a soul and their spiritual friend, or a soul and a spiritual director, or a mentor of some kind, or a confessor, these relationships are critical for our growth and holiness. And we know this not as much here in the interior castle, but in her earlier work, The Life of Teresa of Avila, she spends a lot of time showing us how important spiritual friends are if we're going to make progress, how important good spiritual directors are, what a disaster a bad spiritual director can be. Mm-hmm. She describes all of that. She doesn't repeat that here. But this chapter kind of presumes that you're having those kind of conversations with somebody who's good, reliable, has their head screwed on straight, and also has studied a little bit of theology.
When we talk about those contrasts between the two, I guess it is easy for us to confuse some of those, isn't it? The things that arise from our own emotions, which God gives us, as opposed to those things that come from the deeper spiritual experience.
Sure. In regards to the difference between sweetness in prayer and spiritual consolations, sweetness in prayer is something that is brought about by our efforts in meditation. When we think about God, when we use our imagination to apply ourselves to the sacred scriptures, ponder the life of Jesus and ourselves in relation to that life, we can use our imagination, we can think, we can come into insights, we can read the catechism of the Catholic Church and ponder the relationship of one point of doctrine with another point of doctrine. We can think about also in this meditation, we can think about our own memories. This is what Augustine does, but Teresa also recommends that we can ponder our lives and think about all the different memories we have in our lives, and we can think about those places where God's presence is especially evident to us, and other times when His presence seems so very hidden and distant and far, far away from us. These are things that we can do in our prayer. And oftentimes when we're pondering on our bed and we be still thinking about the times where God seems furthest away, asking ourselves the question, you know, I remember in the scriptures, God worked in all these fantastic, miraculous ways, but in my life right now, He seems to be absent. The reason why the psalmist will pray a prayer like that, or articulate a prayer like that, is because these are all part of our lives. And what's beautiful in the Psalms is when the psalmist calls that to mind, what is he doing? He's searching for God in the places where he seems to be absent from his own experience. And by the end of the psalm, we find the psalmist finding God in those places where he seems. This is hard work, this kind of meditation on the presence of God in our lives, the presence of God in our memories. We sanctify our memories when we do this, and we sanctify our theological thinking and our imagination when we plunge our minds into the sacred scriptures. These are all worthwhile things, but we call this whole range of activity that I've just described for you, we call this meditation. And where meditation leads to is this kind of beautiful silence, this recollection of all our powers in the presence of God. And in that recollection in his presence, there are movements of such wonderful sweetness, even terrible sweetness, where finally we understand something about our lives and the way God's working in them that we didn't understand before. And there's a satisfaction in it that gives us joy. And however true that is, however much joy we might find in such a satisfaction, we also notice there's a kind of sorrow in it too, that somehow this thing that we've just arrived at through our meditation, through pondering our memories or pondering the life of the Lord or pondering the truths of our faith, somehow this thing, this insight that we've just finally achieved, the satisfaction it gives, we realize it's not quite enough. It wakens our hearts. It stirs our hearts with something deep, but something we don't yet possess yet. And so those deep joys that we have in meditation are always tinged by a little bit of sorrow. That would be what Teresa of Avila is calling the sweetness of prayer. And that sweetness of prayer is something that she described, and it sounds ironic or paradoxical, but she talks about weeping over her sins and weeping so hard that she gets a headache. She said the sweetness was so great, and the only thing that would stop me from weeping and experiencing the sweetness is that I'd finally get a headache because I cried so much over you know, my sinfulness and God's goodness to me. And for those who've had such sweet feelings, what a beautiful, beautiful thing to be given. That is no small grace at all. And yet, I can say all of this and tell you that there's something more profound than a sweetness. It's called a spiritual consolation. And the spiritual consolation is not the byproduct of your meditation, your work, turning inwards and reflecting on your memories and searching for God's presence in them, nor is it reliant on your capacity to see the connection between the truths of our faith, as beautiful and resplendent as those may be. That's your work, aided by grace. Only God can help you do that. Only God can help you sanctify your memory. Only God can help you use your imagination in prayer. But we speak about this as kind of a natural sweetness, a natural work, precisely because the way God is helping you is he's doing so by something called cooperating grace. Cooperating grace is a grace by which God cooperates with our activity. He lets us take the lead. He lets us slog it out and use all our natural powers under our own impetus, under our own initiative. And he rejoices that our devotion should be such that we would spend ourselves doing such a thing. It gives him great joy. But all of that hard work on our part, all the determination and perseverance that calls for, as much delight as it gives him, none of it is but a shadow of what he is prepared to do in it. In fact, all of our work, all of our devotional exercises, spiritual exercises in which we employ ourselves are preparing us, making space in our hearts for him to do something even more beautiful and more fruitful. St. Teresa says that this more beautiful, more fruitful thing is not God cooperating with our natural powers. It's more God expanding our capacities. It's his work. He's taking the initiative. He produces something in us that we could never produce ourselves. And he can do so in a single moment, something that we spent years and years and years on in meditation, pondering about. He produces in our souls in a single instant, in an explosion of grace that changes everything inside us. one moment of this spiritual consolation is better than a billion sweetnesses in prayer. And what is more, whereas that sweetness in prayer is tinged by a little bit of sorrow, this spiritual consolation, there is no sorrow in it, because we have a true, at least for a moment, a true possession of him, a possession that far surpasses the sweetness that we had by our meditation. This is what we call mystical contemplation, and it begins to dawn. If in meditation it was to bring me into a place of recollective silence where I'm aware of the presence of God, and so much so that I feel the sweetness of that presence and it pierces me to the heart, but it's also tinged with the idea that I don't yet possess him perfectly. In this fourth mansion, this spiritual consolation, a more perfect possession of him is given to me, a more perfect joy that nothing in this world can ever take away. And this joy purifies and enlarges my soul all at once. And in doing this, something great is being born in me, something so wonderful that it transforms my interior life. It transforms my psychology. So, and she describes this more towards the end, so that rather than being driven so much by my thoughts and prayers, all of a sudden, what is given me is an understanding that is utterly surpassing, an understanding of God and an understanding of myself, a judgment about who I am and a judgment about who God is, that allows me to anticipate what he longs for me to know from all eternity, this vision of him in peace. In this fourth mansion, we begin the transition into this new kind of prayer, the most fruitful, the most powerful, the most wonderful prayer in the life of the church. It begins here. And I'm of the conviction that this fourth mansion is something that most people who are faithful to the Lord, who are devout, who go to confession and try to be devout to the living God, God normally at least lets them taste this consolation at some point in their lives. Oftentimes, it can be close to death because, for whatever reason, somebody had trouble letting go of certain things until the suffering that comes close to death. But normally, for a devout soul that has given himself completely over to the Lord does not withhold this supernatural consolation that he yearns to give us.
Hmm. Wow. There seems to be overshadowing of quite a lovely peace that affects the soul. Is that correct, Anthony?
Well, this has to do with the reordering of things, and there's peace, but it's a peculiar kind of peace, because she says that this peace can include battles with spirits, that sometimes God allows spirits to come into this fourth mansion that are very evil and very, very awful things, and he does this because it's good for us. It helps us go deeper. In the earlier stage of the spiritual life, allowing the evil one to, living with the evil one and all those influences is really bad for our life of prayer, and we need to do everything we can to get away from them. But here, God sometimes allows an evil spirit of some kind or another to creep in there, and it's because he wants us to fight the thing, because when we fight the thing, we grow stronger. He also says, and this is true too, this peace that we have at this stage is not perpetual absorption in God. She sees that as very dangerous, and I've seen people like this too. They get a little taste of prayer, and so they start walking around like they're floating off the ground and always absorbed in God with this kind of weird smile on their face, and their eyes look like they're half asleep, and they're almost like they're comatose or something. Mm-hmm. Teresa of Avila was not comatose. She was grounded in reality, and she was very aware of what was going on, and she was especially aware of the people that God entrusted to her. So we're not supposed to be perpetually absorbed. And so God will sometimes send a little spirit to snap us out of it and get us grounded back in reality, help us join the fray. And so whatever this peace doesn't mean that we don't fight, we don't struggle. There is a struggle. There is a fight. It also doesn't mean that we don't have a gazillion different thoughts exploding in our mind at one time. She says, as I write this, the noises in my head are so loud that I am beginning to wonder what is going on in it. And I said this at the outset, they have been making it almost impossible for me to obey those who have commanded me to write. My head sounds just as if it were full of brimming waters, and then as if all the water in those rivers came suddenly rushing downward. A host of little birds seemed to be whistling, not in the ears, but in the upper part of the head, where the higher part of the soul is said to be. And I've held this view for a long time, for the spirit seems to move upward with great velocity. So this piece also doesn't mean that you stop having mental activity. In fact, just the opposite. You're going to have an explosion of mental activity, more activity than you ever had before, more distraction than you ever had before, more insight than you ever had before. 1,000 thoughts are going to brim over all at once because your mind, your intellect, it knows that we've been touched, knows that something's changed in it, and doesn't know what to do. So it explodes forth in all this thought. The peace doesn't mean then an absence of thought, an absence of struggle, or anything like this. What the peace is that in the face of that explosion, that brimming over of all this new thought, and in the face of great spiritual battles that will need to be ours as we make progress in prayer, in the face of all that, there is a peace given to us that nothing in this world can take away. And it's not because those things are the less in us. No, they are the more. It's because we have him, and when we have him, we can bear all things by the strength he gives us. That's what this prayer actually enables you to engage the fray all the more. It doesn't remove you from the battles of this life or the difficulties or trials or hardships. It allows all those things to become moments of love that give glory to God, and it allows us to do it with a peace that nothing, no power in heaven, no power in hell, no power on this earth can take away.
Sounds a lot like trust.
Amen. It is. It is. Good.
This concludes our radio presentation of this particular program. To hear a special expanded version of this discussion, download or stream the entire Beginning to Pray with Dr. Anthony Lillis podcast, found at discerninghearts.com or inside the Discerning Hearts free app.
You've been listening to Beginning to Pray with Dr. Anthony Lillis. To hear and or to download this conversation, along with hundreds of other spiritual formation programs, visit discerninghearts.com, or you can find it within the free Discerning Hearts app and on other numerous streaming platforms. This has been a production of Discerning Hearts. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. We hope that if this program has been helpful for you, that you will first pray for our mission, which is to offer authentic and rock-solid spiritual formation programs freely to souls around the world. And if you feel us worthy, please consider a charitable donation, which is fully tax-deductible, to help support our efforts. But most of all, we hope that you will tell a friend about discerninghearts.com and join us next time for Beginning to Pray with Dr. Anthony Lillis.